This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The Charlemagne Prize was awarded to Pope Francis, recognizing that he is a voice of conscience that urges people to really put their actions into play.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome, who says the European Union honored Pope Francis today for his efforts regarding migrants and refugees. We'll have full details coming up. Also, Islamic State militants may be preparing to attack Libya's third largest city, Misrata. A popular opposition leader in the DRC says security forces have surrounded his house in Lubumbashi, and the yellow fever outbreak in Angola continues. We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, more than 1,700 migrants and refugees were rescued yesterday on the Mediterranean by the Italian Navy. The Navy carried out 10 separate rescue operations after finding the migrants in rubber boats trying to make their way to Europe. Italian officials say as many as 300,000 migrants and refugees may arrive this year from ports in North Africa. Most are expected to be sub-Saharan Africans. Also, today in Rome, Pope Francis was honored by the EU for his humanitarian efforts regarding migrants and refugees. Reporter Josephine McKenna spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua about the award and the Pope's comments.
The Charlemagne Prize was awarded to Pope Francis, recognizing that he is a voice of conscience that urges people to really put their actions into play, and also recognizes him as an outstanding moral authority who has contributed greatly to peace and solidarity in Europe.
Pope Francis made some comments following his reception of the award. What did he have to say?
Well, this is a very stirring speech by Pope Francis. He looked very emotional after he finished his speech and he received a standing ovation. The Pope said, "I dream of a Europe where being a migrant is not a crime. I dream of a Europe that promotes and protects the rights of everyone without neglecting duties to all." And it's almost a message that resonates in the same way that Martin Luther King's iconic "I Have a Dream" speech did so many years back during the civil rights movement of the 60s. Pope Francis was addressing European leaders, including German Chancellor Angela Merkel, Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi, and Spain's King Felipe VI. He himself is the son of European immigrants to Argentina, and he accepted this prize speaking about the need for integration and dialogue. And he himself acknowledged Europe was engulfed in a crisis of confidence. He called on these European leaders to really recall the contribution and the vision of the founding fathers, who visualized a Europe after World War II that was united, that had a common purpose. I think he and many of the other European leaders here today expressed quite serious observations and concerns that this unity, this common purpose, is under threat by a growing tide of nationalism and opposition to the tidal wave of migrants that we've seen arriving in Europe.
Did any other EU leaders speak at the Vatican today, and what did they say?
There were also powerful speeches by European leaders, including the President of the European Parliament, Martin Schulz, who said that Europe was in danger of squandering its heritage, and he wanted to emphasize that any time that Western Europe did not act in a unified way, the consequences were disastrous. But it was interesting that Mr. Schulz also singled out what he called unscrupulous populists, and I don't know if that was a reference to the new government, the far-right election that we saw there in Austria, but he talked about unscrupulous populists who had no solutions but were taking advantage of the current tensions in Europe to prey on the fears of ordinary people. And he said that that was unproductive and bad policy. We saw some interesting contributions from other European leaders, and it was certainly an opportunity for the Pope to meet and discuss and share ideas about where Europe's going in the future.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome. She spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua. Islamic State militants may be preparing to attack Libya's third largest city, Misrata. The French news agency says militants overran a key crossroads about 120 kilometers south of Misrata. Libyan militias are rushing fighters to the Abu Ghraib crossroads. It's where Libya's coastal highway meets a main road leading to the country's interior. Islamic State has launched an offensive from the city of Sirte, which it captured nearly a year ago. Reports say Sirte has become a training camp and possible staging area for attacks on Europe. It's estimated the militants have between 3,000 and 5,000 fighters in Libya. Also, the World Health Organization reports a breakdown in Libya's healthcare system. It's led to the deaths of 12 newborns in the Sabah Medical Center. The newborns were in a neonatal intensive care center, but died from a bacterial infection and a lack of specialized health staff to care for them. The WHO says the deaths were easily preventable. It warns of further tragedies at the Sabah Medical Center if urgent action is not taken. A popular opposition leader in the DRC says security forces have surrounded his house in Lubumbashi. Moise Katumbi says it happened after he announced his candidacy for president. Constitutional term limits prohibit incumbent President Joseph Kabila from running again, but opponents say he will likely challenge that rule to try to cling to power. Elections are expected late this year, but could be delayed for logistical reasons. Authorities say they are looking into allegations that Katumbi, the former governor of Katanga province, had hired foreign mercenaries. However, an advisor told Reuters that Katumbi had simply hired an American company that provides security guards. Malawi President Peter Mutharika is promising to end the killings of albinos in his country. There's been an upsurge in killings over the past 3 months. Today, the Association of People with Albinism in Malawi reports two more deaths and mutilations. The Malawi leader calls the deaths evil and says they're a threat to the most fundamental human rights. Prior to the killings, the UN had said there were at least 65 attacks on albinos in Malawi, including killings since 2014. Thirteen minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, a new study has confirmed that a certain bacterium is a potent weapon against the Zika virus by targeting the mosquitoes that carry it. Zika is linked to birth defects and neurological disorders. However, the Wolbachia bacterium will not be in widespread use until late this year or early next year, VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Researchers at Brazil's Oswaldo Cruz Foundation have published the first report on the Wolbachia bacterium and its effect on the Zika virus. Wolbachia has been studied for some time, especially in Australia, on slowing the spread of dengue fever. The Aedes mosquito that carries the dengue virus is also responsible for transmitting yellow fever, chikungunya, and Zika. Luciana Moreira is the senior author of the study and part of the Eliminate Dengue project.
I was part of the group when we found that when Wolbachia is spread in Aedes aegypti mosquitoes, these mosquitoes drastically reduced their chance to transmit dengue virus. When I came back from Australia, I brought the project to Brazil in 2012.
Researchers have since been working to release mosquitoes infected with Wolbachia into the wild. The goal is to replace the wild population of mosquitoes with those less likely to transmit dengue.
So with the epidemics of Zika last year, we had this idea to test whether our mosquitoes would block Zika virus as well.
Moreira says researchers do not fully understand why Wolbachia blocks the transmission of the Zika virus. But the bacterium lives within cells, the same place where Zika wants to reside and replicate.
We think that as Wolbachia is there, there is a competition of cell resources, and maybe there is also an issue of immunity. When Wolbachia is present, the mosquito immunity is upregulated, so the mosquito is more immune. Maybe that will directly affect the dengue virus or Zika virus.
Moreira's team of researchers gave Wolbachia-infected mosquitoes in Brazil the Zika virus by feeding them human blood. The blood contained two known strands of Zika circulating in the country. A few weeks later, the mosquitoes had fewer particles of the virus in their bodies and in their saliva. What's more, the virus in the saliva was no longer active. As a result, the mosquitoes could not transmit Zika when biting someone. There's been concern and worry about the Zika virus in Brazil because Rio de Janeiro will host the Olympics in August. But that's actually the winter season in Brazil, which is in the southern hemisphere. The mosquito population is much smaller then and much less active, so Zika transmission should be much lower. However, even if that were not so, Moreira says there's no time to get enough Wolbachia-infected mosquitoes into the wild to make a difference. Instead, standard methods of eliminating mosquito breeding sites and spraying insecticide will be used instead. The good news is once Wolbachia is widespread in the mosquito population, it will remain there for the foreseeable future. Researchers are meeting with Brazilian government officials and donors about gearing up to release Wolbachia-infected mosquitoes late this year.
We are ready to expand, and maybe by the summer season we'll be in a much bigger area and then be able to protect many more people.
Both the World Health Organization and the Pan American Health Organization have said they would support the project. In the Americas, the virus is linked to microcephaly, which can cause small heads and other defects in infants, and Guillain-Barré syndrome, which can trigger partial paralysis. It's not clear whether a Wolbachia project will be launched in Africa. The virus was first discovered in the Zika forest in Uganda in 1947. However, it has not been considered a major problem. Nevertheless, scientists are taking a closer look to see whether cases of birth defects and other health issues have been overlooked. The World Health Organization reports nearly 60 countries and territories have ongoing mosquito-borne transmission. At least 9 countries report evidence of person-to-person transmission, probably through sex. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The first meeting of the U.S.-Tunisia Joint Economic Commission is being held today in Washington. The U.S. delegation is led by Undersecretary of State for Economic Growth, Energy, and the Environment, Catherine Novelli. The Tunisian delegation is headed by Zayed Ladhari, Minister of Vocational Training and Employment. VOA's Mohamed El-Shanawi spoke with the minister about his expectations for the meeting.
You know, it's the first time that we organize this kind of commission, and it's an opportunity for us to show that the United States is standing with Tunisia in this very critical moment in its history, and that it's supporting the transition, the economic transition of Tunisia, as it did with the political transition.
What are the topics on the meeting's agenda?
We will discuss 3 topics. The main objective of the 3 topics is employment and the development of the employability of the private sector. We will discuss 3 major issues: development of SMEs, development of the agribusiness sector, development of the ICT business.
Tunisia is interested in a free trade agreement with the United States. How feasible is that goal?
We think it's feasible because the United States did free trade agreement with Jordan, it did it with Morocco, so why not with Tunisia?
How would that goal help Tunisia facing its economic challenge?
It's important to develop the Tunisian exportations to the United States and to have access to the American market. It's very important that the Tunisian products can be sold here in the United States. We think that is an issue will take a long time to be finalized, but at least let's begin the negotiation process. It's important to start now because it's an important matter for us, and we look for the same opportunity offered for Morocco or Jordan.
How would you describe the U.S. economic assistance to the young democracy in Tunisia?
Right now, the United States did really an important effort to support Tunisia in this very critical moment of its history. We are grateful for the United States for support, the assistance. We think it was important on the security side and the economic side. We think that the United States can play a more important role in mobilizing the international community and the major Western countries to support Tunisia in the next years. And it's very important that the G7 countries can also be mobilized by the United States to be more involved in the economic transition in Tunisia.
What are the most urgent economic and financial challenges facing Tunisia and your plans to tackle them?
Unemployment is one of the major issues we are facing, and we are trying to tackle it by fixing the economy and the economic growth of the country and stimulating the economic activities and the business across the country, and especially in the interior regions suffering from marginalizations for decades. It's really important to also offer more assistance and more support for job seekers in terms of coaching and individual counseling, so as they can meet the requirements of the market and they can play a more active role in building their own professional project and being the actors of their own future. Promoting entrepreneurship is one of the tools we are trying to use also to fight unemployment and to promote free initiative culture in the country. It's very important that our people take the initiative, and it's important that our population be empowered and responsibilized to take its own future in their hands and then to work hard to succeed, because we think that we can succeed. It's possible. As we succeed politically, we can succeed economically. The Joint Economic Commission is really a great opportunity for Tunisians to benefit from the support of the American friends, and we will do our best to succeed and bring more prosperity and more economic opportunities for our countries.
Syed Lahari is Tunisia's Minister of Vocational Training and Employment. He spoke with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. 23 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. While economic inequality, climate change, and deforestation can be a lethal combination for indigenous peoples who depend on the land for their food and livelihood. For several years now, the New York-based Ford Foundation has been working to enable indigenous peoples to control the land they live on and thrive economically in a rapidly warming world. To find out more about Ford's work in Africa, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with David Kamowitz, the foundation's director of natural resources and climate change.
Well, here at the Ford Foundation, our major global concern is the question of inequality in all of its different forms. And one of the most important forms of inequality is because so many people around the world depend directly on natural resources, on land, on forests, on water, on fishing resources for their survival. And whether people have access to those natural resources or whether they're all grabbed by a few wealthy or powerful people is really at the heart of inequality in many places. And it links into climate change, both because we found that communities can be a real positive solution for climate change, and also because, of course, climate change affects poor people and rural people much more than it affects the rich and the urban. And Africa is a somewhat of a special case because most of the land in Africa traditionally has been held by communities. It's the communities that manage the land. It's the communities that occupy the land. But according to most African laws, communities aren't formally the land owners. The government claims to own most of the land and most of the forest of Africa. So this makes communities very vulnerable to outside groups that may want to come and grab their land or grab their forests to use for other purposes. That's a real problem in Africa in particular, and we're seeing it get worse very quickly, actually.
Make the connection for me about the government owning the land and then other people coming in to grab it. Is it because the government is sometimes in not very wholesome cahoots with these people who stand to profit from the land that they grab?
Well, sometimes the governments are well-intentioned. They think that the lands that the communities are sitting on could be more productive if they were put into some big oil palm plantation, and they think that that's going to develop the country. Other times, they don't really care about the development. They just are interested in getting a bribe or getting some sort of kickback from giving this land to other people. But in either case, the result is that in many parts of Africa, the governments are, if you will, giving away lands that communities have been and forests that communities have been sitting on for generations.
Tell me in broad strokes what Ford Foundation is trying to do to address this problem.
We're working with African governments. We're working with indigenous peoples organizations. We're working with NGOs to ensure that the land tenure policies protect the rights of local communities, particularly traditional communities, and in doing so, that helps to support the world's struggle against climate change.
How do you get governments who may have a financial incentive to allow large corporations to come in, and how do you get them to see that it's in their interest to protect these small ethnic minorities and other people? I mean, you would think on the face of it that it sounds nice, but isn't very practical in terms of what they want.
One thing is to show governments that often the people that come in that want these resources make a lot of promises, but that they don't actually keep those promises. So they will come in and they'll tell the governments, we're going to provide this much in taxes, we're going to provide this much in employment, we're going to be producing this much in exports, but often they don't deliver. So it's important that governments know that so that they know what they're getting into.
I can understand why, from an equality and social justice point of view, it might be a terrific concern for you, but I don't know why it's an environmental issue per se.
Well, it's a big climate change problem, particularly when we talk about the humid part of Africa, when we talk about the Democratic Republic of Congo or the other Congo Basin countries. For the most part, the deforestation of these areas has been very low. They still have a large part of their forest intact. But now we see that the possibility of big investments coming in that could clear out very large amounts of forest in a very short period of time. That would have the double effect of both creating a lot of climate change by clearing land and the smoke going into the atmosphere, and also would be pushing out the traditional communities of these African countries.
David Kamowitz, the Ford Foundation's Director of Natural Resources and Climate Change, he spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.